New and exclusive on Disney Plus. Meet the powerhouse divorce lawyers.
Deep breath. Tell us your story.
Kim Kardashian, Naomi Watts, Sarah Paulson, and Glenn Close, who don't just play the game, they change it.
You can't tell us to stop.
This November,
showtime, ladies.
Never settle.
Love and war.
All's fair. A new Hulu original series exclusively on Disney Plus. 18 plus subscription required. T's and C's apply.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to The Advisor. I'm Stacey Chalemi. Today, we're making fertility simple and hopeful. IVF, egg freeze-in genetic testing, and how AI is changing care with Dr. Banna. Dr. Banna is a double board certified in OBGYN and reproductive endocrinology and infertility. And if this conversation helps you, remember to follow, subscribe, and share with somebody who needs it. Today's episode is brought to you by Dr. Bradley Nelson. He is a two-time best-selling author. And I'd like to introduce you now to Dr. Banna. We're so glad that you're here today. You know, what you do is so important. And I'm so glad that you could come to us and share this great information. Now, for listeners meeting you for the first time, who are you and what led you to launch a personalized fertility practice in Orange County?
Sure. Thank you for that introduction, Stacey. So my name is Dr. Banna Kashani, and I am a fertility specialist here in Orange County, California. I have really been passionate about helping couples start families, in whatever way that means, or in helping women preserve their fertility. And this all started back in my training when I was noticing how it's difficult for some couples to get pregnant. Meanwhile, there's some people that unfortunately don't want children who are able to conceive. And I figured sometimes the world isn't a fair place. What can I do? How can I make it my mission to help some couples be able to start a family and, you know, be these amazing parents and raise these kids? And so that's where I found passion in reproductive endocrinology and infertility. And I started my continued my training in that. And I found that there was an additional need where it's such an emotional process. It's so, you know, trying for ups and downs and roller coasters that come with it. And I felt like patients need a little bit more of a personalized approach to their care. They don't want to feel like they're just a number and that name going to a clinic. They really need, you know, somebody who listens, who can connect and really hone in on what might help them in particular. No two people are the same. You don't want a cookie cutter approach. You want to feel like your doctor is listening to you. And so that's how I started my practice in Orange County. And I love what I do. And I feel so blessed to be able to help couples and families, you know, start this miracle journey of having a child. So
I think that's so wonderful. There's been so many times where, you know, I've had many friends that have struggled to have children. I've had friends that have several miscarriages, and I've had friends that even one friend I can remember, you know, she carried all the way to the 9-month term. And then all of a sudden, you know, she broke her water just a little bit early. And by the time she got to the hospital, she had a miscarriage. And, you know, and then I had some friends that, you know, were told late early on in life in their 20s that, you know, I'm sorry, but, you know, you're probably going to have a very difficult time trying to have children, you know, because of these complications. And so, you know, throughout their whole life, they just didn't wanted to be a mother, but they didn't know if they could be a mother. And they had that on their back emotionally. And for them, it meant a lot because motherhood was very special to them. It's something they want to experience in their lifehood, you know, and to know that, you know, right away at such an early age that this might not be an option for you was devastating to a few of my friends. And so I'm so glad there are people like you that could actually work with the people and make it so personable, you know, because I don't like when you go into a doctor's office and you feel like you're just a number. When you have a doctor that looks at you with compassion in their eyes and they're really in tune to what you're saying. And then they really, you could see they're doing the best they can and all they can to try to make that opportunity of becoming a mother and having a family a true reality is so, so important and so very special. And I'm so glad there are people like you who take it to the next level. I think it's so important that they have people that, you know, look at you as a person and not just a number.
Thank you. Yes. I think it's hard for people even to initiate a consultation a lot of times because it's in some ways there's this taboo around, oh, well, I can't carry or I can't get pregnant. Sometimes for some women, they feel this emotional toll that it takes on them. And so I said, like I said, there's a taboo around it. You don't even want to set up the consultation, or you've heard a bad story, or you've already been kind of approached in a way like you can't have children. And so it shuts people off. So I think that my biggest thing at that first consultation, I spend a lot of time, my consultations are an hour long. I really want people to feel heard and we can map out a process to help them. So.
I love that. Now, what's the simplest way to explain fertility basics like ovulation time and egg quality, sperm health for someone who's just starting?
Yeah, so I think that I tend to like to break it up into like four main factors to keep it simple because it can be so overwhelming, a million tests and various things to be done. So I
Yeah.
usually sit down, I have this little paper in my office, and I'll be like, there's four factors that can affect things. And I start with the top. One could be male factor. Male factor comes down to sperm health, right? And are there enough sperm? Are they swimming well? Do they look normal? And that can be assessed with a simple semen analysis, which is just basically providing a sample of ejaculate sperm. We look under a microscope and we get a report. And it's so important to not to skip that step because at least one third of couples, we may identify there's a sperm related factor that could be contributing. And there's fixable things that can be done, lifestyle, diet, et cetera. These things can actually improve sperm parameters. That's the first one. So the next three are related to females and what can impact their ability to conceive. So one of those is going to be uterine factor. Is the uterus, the womb, is it normal in shape, in appearance? Is there anything inside the uterus that could be preventing pregnancy or causing miscarriages? You want to look for anatomic things like fibroids, overgrowth of tissue called endometrial polyps. Maybe there's scar tissue in the uterus. So that's the uterine factor. And I tell people, imagine this is like an empty room. That's where you want to carry your child for 9 months. You don't want to start off with that room full of furniture and clutter. You want to have a blank slate. You want that empty room so that the child can grow. So that's the uterine factor. Number three is the fallopian tubes. The fallopian tubes is where everything happens. So from the moment you release an egg or ovulate an egg, it has to enter the tubes, and that's where the egg sits and waits for some special sperm to make its way there. So if there's a problem with the fallopian tubes or blockage or there's a damage to them, this can impact your ability to get pregnant. So that's the third factor. And finally, and most importantly, is the ovarian factor or your egg. So that's number four. So eggs are very important to being able to conceive, and egg quality is almost solely related to a female's age. In our
Yeah.
20s, our eggs are great. They're crystal clear. We take them out. You look here, there's like an egg right here. That's what an egg looks like in a 20-year-old. It's nice, round, plump, and clear. In your 30s, there's starting to be granularity within eggs. And then unfortunately, in your 40s, the eggs are abnormally shaped. There's breakdown in the eggs, the quality declines. And so that can really impact success and ability to get pregnant. And what happens is you can get pregnant, you can have chromosome issues in the baby, which leads to miscarriages. And then obviously knowing your menstrual cycle is critical. If you do get a regular period, it's pretty typical every 28 days, let's say, or every 32 days, but it comes every month, then that demonstrates that you are ovulating and releasing an egg. If there's any concerns that your periods are all over the place, irregular, bleeding between periods, this might be a sign of, no ovulation. And without an egg ovulating, you can't conceive. So again, summarizing, there's the male factor, uterine factor, tubal factor, ovarian factor, probably ovarian factor, and age is the single most important thing.
Wow, there's a lot to consider. There's a lot to consider. And I think sometimes people don't even realize all those pillars that are involved. I think it's really important that you sit down with somebody and you really explain those factors to people, because I think people just understand what they know or what they see on YouTube or what they're looking for when they're Googling information about wanting to have a child. But when you sit down with someone who's well educated in the area of expertise and they can go through it step by step and they can explain it to you, it really helps people understand and get a clear idea of what's the next step, what's necessary. And it doesn't, the more you know, the less you fear. And so I think that's really good that you could break it down to those four factors and really give people a clear understanding of what they really need to know and acknowledge in this,
Absolutely.
yeah, most
And I
definitely.
like how you said the more you know, the less fear there is. I like to say knowledge is power, right? Because if you don't have that information, you'll never know. And so for women, some women have great egg numbers even into their like 30s or 40s, and some women unfortunately lose eggs faster, or they're born with less eggs. If you never get a blood test or you never get checked for any of these things, you won't know. So again, the more you know, the less fear there is, and the more you can map and plan like your reproductive plans or lifestyle for the future.
Exactly. Now, when should someone see a fertility specialist instead of waiting? Like, what are the red flags or the timelines?
Yeah, so absolutely. If you're under the age of 35 and you've been trying for a year, you should be seen. There's no question about that. Most couples, 85% of people will get pregnant within a year of unprotected intercourse if they're less than 35. If you're over 35, then after 6 months of trying, you shouldn't hesitate. You should be seen. Those are just basic kind of timelines. But if somebody has a history of irregular periods, like they've been told they have polycystic ovary syndrome, or they don't really ovulate, there's no need for you to wait a year to go get seen, right? You should be seen within a month of deciding you want to get pregnant. If your partner had chemotherapy in the past and might have from cancer, unfortunately, or had, surgeries that were related to the testicles, you shouldn't delay. Your partner should get a semen analysis and be seen right away. If you have endometriosis and you have debilitating periods and pain, you've had surgery for that, that is someone who should be seen right away by a fertility specialist rather than waiting like a whole year of trying, because those are people that likely will need a little bit of assistance to get pregnant.
I like that. That's a great answer. Now, which tests actually matter early on? Like, is a semen analysis like one of the most important tests you can sh should consider, and which ones get overhyped?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think a semen analysis, as I said, is critical because a lot of men will have some things that they would never know about until you take a look. So that, and it's correctable. Men get to make new sperm every 72 days. So if you can identify something going on, you can at least start working towards improving that. So that's definitely should be done. I'm a big fan of doing ovarian reserve or fertility tests for women. And the two simple things are one, an ultrasound where you actually look at the ovary. We see these little black circles within the ovary. They look like chocolate chips in a chocolate chip cookie, right? If you take a look at a woman's ovary and you see a bunch of these follicles or black circles, that represents a good egg quantity. If you're taking a look at someone who's 28 and has like three follicles, you can automatically see something's going on and you want to act sooner than later because their quantity of eggs are going down. So I like those two tests, an ultrasound and the semen analysis. And then there's a corresponding blood test called AMH or anti-Müllerian hormone. And that also gives us a sense of egg quantity, kind of the higher the number, the better. It doesn't reflect your ability to get pregnant, but it tells you about quantity and kind of your reproductive timeline. So if you were like, hey, I'm 32, but we don't want kids for 5 years, at least get an AMH done. If it's low, then maybe, yeah, you could postpone having children for 5 years, but maybe you should freeze embryos or do something instead, because if you wait 5 years, you might not have any eggs left. So those are kind of the biggest ones. Some of the things that are kind of overhyped is a lot of like these, immunologic tests that, well, most people don't have a problem with their immune system rejecting the baby, or doing all these tests for random blood clotting disorders. Those typically are not at play. So I'm kind of would say we have to prioritize what we do, and I would just start with those two basic things, and making sure, of course, a woman ovulates.
Right. Now, can you walk us through the IVF in plain language, like the steps, the timeline, and what typical patient experiences during this time?
Absolutely. So let me just make it basic first. Every
Okay.
single month, a woman has a set number of eggs available in their ovaries. Let's just say hypothetically, that's 15 eggs that are ready that month. Well, in a normal menstrual cycle, a typical month, your body only allows one of those 15 eggs to grow and mature and ovulate. The other 14 eggs, unfortunately, by the end of the cycle, they die off. They undergo something called atresia, which basically means they expire and they disappear and go away. They're kind of wasted in a way. So with IVF, you have these 15 potential eggs. Let's not waste them. Let's get all 15 of those eggs to hopefully grow and mature and take them out of the body. And the typical way this happens is a woman gets their period. They start hormone injections and they do these shots for about 10 nights every night until those eggs are ready and mature. And you're seen regularly with ultrasounds and you do blood work during that 10 or 10 day period. And when the eggs are ready, then we plan this procedure to take the eggs out. The procedure is a very minor procedure. It's under sedation. You're still breathing on your own with a little bit of medications to help you sleep. Everything's done vaginally. There's no incisions made. And most people go home and rest that day and can go back to work the following day. So it basically takes about 2 weeks, a little less than 2 weeks for this process. So it goes by actually really fast. People think IVF is this long, drawn out process, but it's actually not. For your time commitment, it's about 2 weeks. And then what happens is everything's done in the lab. The magic happens there. So the day of your retrieval, the lab, which is a scientist in the lab, an embryologist looks at the eggs under a microscope. The ones that look good and mature can then be fertilized individually with sperm. And then you wait to see if an embryo is created. And those embryos grow in the lab for 5 to 7 days. Typically, that would be happening in the female's fallopian tube, but we see this happening in the lab, which is shown right here. And then those embryos can be tested for genetic conditions, chromosomal problems. You can see if there's Down syndrome or other different genetic conditions. And then the embryo can be put directly back into the uterus, or it could be frozen and transferred at a later date. And that's more of what we're doing nowadays is we're testing the embryos for genetic testing, we're freezing embryos, and we're putting them back later, the month after, or somebody wants to come back 5 years later. You could do either.
I love that. What should people know about success rates and risks and expectations so there's no scare tactics and it's just honest coaching so they know what's really going on?
Sure. So success rates are all based on a female's age. This just comes down to eggs and egg quality, uterine health, et cetera. So higher success is always going to be seen in someone who's less than 30 or in their early 30s, and success does go down significantly late 30s or in your 40s. I mean, nationally, the IVF success rate at age 42 is about 5 to 10%. And I think people don't realize how low that is because we see and hear a lot of stories about women getting pregnant later in life, but a lot of people have to do multiple rounds of IVF, or they're using maybe assistance of donor eggs from a younger woman. So I think that's really important. And that's where I come back to emphasizing how much age matters. Regardless of that, in terms of the scary things that are heard, I think there's a lot around it. You know, it's a different process to consider. It definitely, if you're scared of needles and injections, it's a lot to overcome. But typically, the whole process goes by so fast for my patients. I mean, within a blink of an eye, we are like, wow, we start the injections, and less than 2 weeks later is the procedure. And once you get the hang of doing these little, they're tiny shots, they're like subcutaneous. They're all the like if you know about Ozempic or Mounjaro or all these tirzepatide, I mean, they're like that kind of injections. And so most of the time, once you get the hang of it, you can handle doing that. And people, it's not so bad. People will have a little bit of bloating, of course, you know, and sometimes you'll feel more emotional. It's not unlikely to cry easily during this process. But after that 2 weeks, you know, you recover a little bit. By the time you get your next period, your hormones, your ovaries are basically back to where they were. So it's not this like long drawn out process. A lot of people worry about gaining weight. Most of it's just temporary and water weight. And by the time again you get your cycle, you're back to where you were. So I think there's a lot of concerns with a lot of the hormones and things that come about, but I think that overall it's pretty minimal. People handle it pretty well.
That's great. Now, how do you keep IVF patients centered and compassionate in the process so they can feel clinical?
Can I get a little bit more of a rephrasing of that question? I just want to make sure I
Sure,
understand.
yeah, of course. So like during the time, like you had mentioned, people tend to get emotional and they had that, we talked about that fear base, like wait, they start to, they're worried, oh my God, maybe this never will happen, while they're going through the process, because I'm sure it is very stressful for them because they're thinking in their head the what if, and oh, maybe this won't happen and it won't work. And how does that, how do you help them? Because you talked about being very compassionate versus a lot of the other doctors. What are some things that really help the patients?
Absolutely. So first off, the way that my practice differs is that a lot of practices are set up where you might be have an ultrasound done by a sonographer or a nurse, and the doctor waits for the results and has the staff coordinate and communicate with the patients. But I like to do my own ultrasounds at every single visit. After every visit, patients get to come to my office and sit with me and go over their ultrasound results and know their plan. They have an opportunity to ask me questions face to face. And I think that in itself is so incredibly helpful. They're not constantly having to Google things, go online, read other people's stories and situations. They can ask me. And I think that that makes a difference. But beyond that, I mean, no matter what, I'm not with them all day, every day. So the things that I think are really helpful in the process, especially with taming anxieties and worries and fears, is one, doing meditation, stress relief tactics, yoga, or like meditation are great during this process. Some people will talk to or see an acupuncturist, and that's very beneficial. It just allows people for some time to, get very zen and feel comfortable in a quiet room, and then have the benefits of, acupuncture, which is combining Eastern and Western medicine. So that's really helpful. And then sometimes a support group or support network, and there's a lot of those out there that's really nice too.
I like that idea. I think those are all great, ideas. Like I like the fact that you could work one-on-one with them. You can, 'cause a lot of times I know when I was going through medical issues, I'd go and I'd have like a list of questions. And a lot of times, like, I would look up things on the internet and, they're like, oh, no. And then they could correct me and they would put me on the right path. Because a lot of times you do look up things on Google or you get advice from people and it's not the right advice, whether it's wrong information, it's misinformation, or somebody's just different than you. So they're gonna have different symptoms or different ideas of things. And it's always really good to work with your doctor and really, express how what you're going through. That way your doctor can understand and then really give you a one-on-one consultation where they can explain in a more thorough way of different things that you personally would benefit from. Because on the internet and even support groups, sometimes I think support groups are great, don't get me wrong, but it's great when you can actually speak with your doctor and you could actually, get your doctor knows his after time, gets to know you on a personable level and really understand probably what your needs are. And I think the yoga and the meditation is great because I think that's a great way of really getting yourself to that level where you can, bring yourself to a level of calmness and help you with your stress that you're going through during that time. So I think that's great advice.
Yeah. Thank you.
Now, who is egg freezing? What is like who are the best candidates for that? And what's the best age window to consider that?
That's a great question. So, in general, if we want to keep it simple, I think if you're considering egg freezing, doing it less than the age of 35 is ideal. The quality of eggs under the age of 35 are about 70-80% good quality. Okay. Obviously, the younger you are, the better. After the age of 35, you can still do egg freezing. I had an egg freezing patient yesterday who's 39, right? But you do need to know that the quality of the eggs are lower, and so therefore you might need to do multiple cycles and freeze more mature eggs than somebody else who is younger. And so I think egg freezing is great to consider probably in your late 20s or early 30s, especially if you know that, like, hey, I'm career driven, I'm bound to getting my PhD. This is going to take 8 years, and I'm not going to be able to, work, have a child sooner. I think I should freeze my eggs just in case. But there's plenty of women. Unfortunately, it's really hard to find the right ideal partner nowadays, and you're not sure, and you don't want to just settle into a relationship just to have children. I think that if you're in your early 30s and you're single, you should really be considering doing egg freezing, because even though you may never need those eggs, right? Like, you could do egg freezing at 31, be married at 35, and have a kid right away, no problem, right? You won't use those eggs. But you just never know. And there's no crystal ball to outline our future or what's going to happen. And also, what if you can get pregnant even at 38 with your first child? You're perfectly fine and there's no issues. But when you go to have a second or a third child at 40, 41, 42, and that's difficult, you have frozen your eggs. You can always use those. So I don't think that there's a lot of downside of committing yourself to 1 month in your life to doing this, setting aside these eggs. And again, you may not need them, you may not use them, but they're there and they can be used at any time point. So I really like to have people start considering this in their late 20s, early 30s. Get your, and you don't have to jump into it. I'll see a lot of people and be like, you're 32, your numbers look really good, right? Your egg quantity numbers look good. And let you're not ready, this is a hard year. Come back and see me in a year. Let's just track your numbers, make sure things aren't dropping, you didn't drop off on your egg quantity a lot, and then we can revisit this. And so that's another option. But like you had said, the more information you get sooner, the better, so you can make those educated decisions and plans. And thankfully, a lot of companies and employers and insurances are now covering egg freezing, so it is more available than it was before. And if not, even so, financially, the cost of egg freezing has gone down over the years, and the success rate is getting better. Our technology is getting better. So there's just so many reasons why women should consider doing this if they have the opportunity or even have the slightest of concerns with their future fertility.
Oh, I love that. Now, how many eggs should someone aim to freeze for a reasonable chance for a future pregnancy?
Great question that comes up all the time. And so a lot of the data and information that we had was from like a lot of older studies from 2012 and beyond, when egg freezing just became non-experimental. And we used to tell women, okay, if you're less than 35, freeze 15 mature eggs, and that should yield one live birth. Okay. And if you're 40, you got to freeze at least 30 mature eggs or more, which is still, I think, a very valid kind of number, but it's going to vary based on your age. And so, one of the new studies that just came out in our main journal called Fertility and Sterility, it just was published this September of 2025. And they actually did something really, really cool. They broke it down into a percentage per egg frozen, to get one live birth. And one live birth means not just one pregnancy, meaning one child delivered full term, for example, or delivered. So they said for women who are age 35 and under, each mature egg frozen has about a 13% chance of one live birth. Okay. And for a woman who's 40, you're going to be shocked, but if you freeze one mature egg, it's about a 4% chance of one live birth. It's drastically different. And it's just related to the changes in the egg quality, the chromosomes within the eggs. So when you're younger, ideally less than 35, yeah, freezing 10, 15 mature eggs is going to be great. When you're 40, you can see you really need that number to get above 20, 25 mature eggs, to get one live birth at least. And so that's why sometimes you can't get 20, 25 eggs in one egg freezing cycle. That's where you might need to do two cycles or three cycles as you get older, versus when you're younger, you do it, you just do it one time and you're done. So.
Oh my goodness. Now, for a single woman and couples, what's the most practical plan and tips for medical, emotional, financial?
For single women, or
For
these
single
single
women
women
and
who are trying
couples.
to do egg freezing? So, I mean, I think that, like I said, there are a lot of companies that are now providing a fertility benefit for egg freezing. If not, there are definitely different programs out there. There's grants out there. There's loans that are available. Some people will even get a low interest credit card and get services through that to be able to do egg freezing. And same thing goes for couples. I mean, financially, this is a huge toll and burden, right? And it's something that it's not really fair. Like, why can't infertility and services be covered by for everyone through their insurance? Why is it that this one area you have to pay out of pocket for? But as I said, more and more states are mandating insurance coverages. Some employers are providing specific fertility benefits and riders. And then there are various programs that provide fertility loans for couples, and you can pay off these amounts over the years. So there's different circumstances that are available. And as I said, there are certain grants through lots of different companies that are available. You apply, you give your application, and that can be very helpful as well.
That's great to know, because I didn't even realize that a lot of the insurance companies do actually cover for egg freezing. That's news to me, actually.
Yeah, they're picking this up more and more. It's still a little bit tricky because some companies will be like, sure, we'll cover infertility if you can't get pregnant, but not egg freezing. But as I said, I think that, since there's the big companies like Google and Apple have jumped on the bandwagon of providing egg freezing, a lot of other bigger companies are providing that benefit as well. So hopefully, as the years go by, this will just be more expanded services to more and more people throughout the country.
I think that's great. Now, can you speak to common misconceptions around PGT, like for the accuracy and the designer baby fairs and so forth?
Yeah, so this is a hot topic for sure. PGT stands for pre-implantation genetic testing. So what that means is in the lab, when an embryo makes it to this final stage called the blastocyst, there's a part that's the baby inner cell mass and the part of the embryo that becomes the placenta. We can biopsy these cells and we can send it out for genetic testing or analysis. And we're taking about 5 to 10 cells from the outside, not from the baby. So as you can see, it's not 100%. It's a really good screening measure, but what we're finding is you could just get a sample that comes back normal, or you could get a sample that comes back abnormal, but the actual baby is okay. Nevertheless, if an embryo comes back normal, the likelihood that the baby is healthy and doesn't have a chromosomal issue is at least about 98%. So that's really good. What we're finding is sometimes we get these results that come back abnormal, but is the baby really abnormal? We don't know. We have to assume that there's concerns there, and we rather not risk transferring a baby that might have a chromosomal, abnormality. So the theory behind designer babies, I mean, it's really more so just, hey, I want to know before I get pregnant if my child has Down syndrome or a major chromosomal abnormality, because I don't want to put myself through that. Some women have had multiple miscarriages, and it's all due to chromosome factors. So they rather not get pregnant and go through that huge roller coaster, being pregnant, losing the pregnancy. They want to know ahead of time that the baby has the normal chromosomes and is healthy. Now, in terms of a more advanced form of PGT, there are certain types of PGT testing that can help us eliminate specific genetic diseases. And this is only, it's not for every single condition by any means. But let's say a couple is found to have a certain type of gene mutation. Each of them carry this gene mutation for something called muscular dystrophy, for example. They don't know because they're healthy, their other good gene is fine, but they have one bad gene. And same thing with their partner. Well, then their child could have muscular dystrophy. It's about a 25% chance. And that's kind of a devastating disease to have to go through, because you don't find out till maybe your baby's one and they have difficulty walking or meeting milestones. So what happens there is if you are identified preconception before you're trying to get pregnant, that you both carry these abnormal genes, you can then do the specific PGT. It's called PGT-M, as in Mary, for monogenic diseases, and you can isolate and identify which embryos are affected and not choose to transfer them. And so this comes up sometimes when a couple never knew their child was born, has severe, severe anemia, for example, constantly hospitalized with blood transfusions, et cetera. And they're already dealing with having to care for a child that, has significant health problems. They're like, look, before we have another child, we rather test and make sure we can eliminate this disease. So that's what's available. But it's not like we can go in and be like, hey, I want blue eyes and blonde hair and 5'9". Like you can't design that part of the baby. Like you can't do that. It's all over and out there that this is what people are doing. But like I said, there's valid reasons to help, couples try to have a child that doesn't get affected by severe genetic conditions. And it's making a huge difference in families' lives, especially if there's already a family member or sibling that has been affected by a severe condition.
Wow. Now, where is AI showing up in fertility labs right now? That how the embryo assessment lab workflow, and what excites you the most about this now?
So, I mean, one of the biggest things that AI has done is develop something called the EmbryoScope, which is an incubator where every single embryo has a little camera attached to it, and you can actually watch the development of the embryo in time lapse. So you could see it go from one cell to two cells, four cells, eight cells over the course of like 5, 6, 7 days. So you could literally go back and streamline and be like, oh, from the beginning, those cells didn't divide even. And the lab, because you don't have to keep opening up the incubator, taking the embryos out, going to a microscope, moving them around, and things like that. So seen is that we are starting to develop techniques and strategies to do ICSI or inseminate sperm into the egg. And so that is something that AI is helping in the lab. And it's just helping us better select embryos and just streamline processes. There's a lot of technology there where also each embryo or dish is labeled with technology called RFID technology. So samples don't get mixed up, everything's scanned into a computer system, it's witnessed better. And so we're developing a lot of advancements in the lab. And then on the clinical side, there are now some AI algorithms available to help us in kind of, doing ultrasounds and deciding, hey, this would be an optimal time to plan the retrieval. I'm still not jumping on that bandwagon just yet. I think there's still a lot left to be done to help perfect that skill. But like I said, this is really nice for areas where maybe there's less access to good for, a lot of fertility specialists, and you do need to have other providers helping. This could be really helpful in that circumstance. So we're moving along and we're getting better, but I think it's still some of it, as with everything in AI, it still is a work in progress.
Right, I agree with you. Now, what should patients ask clinicians and about their privacy, their validation, and AI tools, that are being used? How much of their information is actually going to be, put out there, and how much is actually going to be kept private?
Yeah, I think that every patient needs to be informed if a clinic or company is working with an AI company, especially for the clinical side of things. Sometimes these different companies are working on collecting patient data, looking at their ovarian reserve parameters, then seeing how they respond to the stimulation medications, developing algorithms on protocols, et cetera. So if any of your clinic is working with one of these companies, you should be informed, and you can opt in or opt out, obviously. So that's really critical. But beyond that, I think with what's happening in the lab with the EmbryoScope and things like that, that data is really left internal within the clinic and lab site. It's not working with other companies. So typically, you're just informed, yeah, we have an EmbryoScope. It's more so for the lab purposes of being able to watch the embryos, but it's not necessarily going to be utilized or your data going to be given to any other company. But again, it's variable per clinic. You should ask if you're wondering, just to be sure.
I think that's great advice. Now, what would you share to a DI for, like, if there's a patient story that really changed your journey, like during the time that you've been a doctor in this field? Is there like one particular story that really, kind of changed your whole, view of how you feel about being who you are as a fertility specialist?
I mean, thankfully, there's been a lot of patients out there, and I'm like streaming my mind trying to think of like who stands out. I think that one of my patients herself actually got pregnant. One of my very, very special patients actually got pregnant on her own naturally, and unfortunately experienced a pregnancy loss at about 5 months, where she just went into preterm labor and delivery. And came out of nowhere. You would never know. She was otherwise incredibly young, healthy, early 30s. And after that loss of her daughter, she had to have a procedure because she was bleeding, and it really impacted her uterus to the point where her uterus ended up getting damaged. And she also was found to have like a shortened cervix. And so she went through, I mean, every single possible thing you can imagine, to correcting the cervix by getting sutures placed to hold the pregnancy for the future, to cleaning out the uterus, removing the scar tissue, helping that. And her uterus never went back to the way it was, right? It was just affected after this unfortunate loss. But she was determined and she was resilient and she never gave up. Although other doctors may have suggested she just, not carry again and maybe use a surrogate, she persevered so much and went through honestly a 2 to 3 year journey of getting embryos, doing IVF, trying different transfers, seeing if there was anything at all that we could do to help her be pregnant and carry this pregnancy. And thankfully she persevered and she made it and she was able. And it's like it stands out to me because I don't think any other person would, be able to handle all that. But I think that when you have this goal in mind and being able to have the journey of carrying a pregnancy, delivering on your own, and having that bond for some people is so critical. And it was very special to watch them go through that. For their second child, they did use a gestational carrier, and they knew because it took like years to get there, they didn't want to do that. They wanted to have their children closer together. And that was also the most beautiful journey too. So basically she got to carry one baby. She had a gestational carry and that carrier, carry another baby. And now she has two healthy children and it's doing so well. Not to say it was easy, not to say it didn't take years and had ups and downs of its own. But, like I said, if you keep going, it will be worth it. It really will be.
Oh, that's so wonderful. That's a wonderful story. I think it's so worth it when you have stories like that, and people can relate to them sometimes too. And sometimes it's just a small portion of the story that people kind of, can hone into, and it makes such a difference. And it's so nice to hear positive stories like that because it makes people feel that they're not alone and that there is hope. And so it's wonderful to hear that. I really that's a wonderful story. Now, what 1 week action plan would give someone today, that you would give someone today to help them explore IVF or just get them back into basic labs?
Sure. Yeah. So I think the 1 week action plan would be go ahead, see a fertility doctor, get an ultrasound done to check your ovaries and see your follicle count and your AMH at the very minimum, the anti-Müllerian hormone. And that would be great. And if your provider can order a sperm test for your partner, that would be amazing. That would be lovely to start with. Other labs that are important for your fertility are checking your thyroid health, vitamin D levels, blood counts. These things are also really critical in having normal ovulation and the ability to conceive. And just start to be as healthy as you can. Think about everything you're doing. I mean, unfortunately, our day-to-day is filled with lots of stress, environmental toxins, pollutants. And so being mindful of maybe taking a prenatal vitamin, start thinking about having foods that are less processed on a day-to-day, more antioxidants in both you and your partner's diet, blueberries, pomegranates, acai. This is something you can start immediately and will have very lasting impacts. And cutting out, other toxins that are around us potentially, from plastics and drinking out of plastic water bottles to cookware, and also, having less alcohol and caffeine and any other drugs is going to be critical to improving your fertility.
Wow. Now, is there a specific myth or something that you constantly hear that you wish you could help people like just make it disappear from their mind? Like, is there a specific thing that you hear all the time? You're like, no, that's not true. That's not accurate.
Yeah, there's a lot, but let me start with something fresh in my mind because it's all over talking about autism, right? I think everyone thinks that IVF will cause autism, and it really isn't the case. And the best data that we have actually comes from, Denmark, where they have registries of patients who a lot of IVF is available over there, for most of the population. A lot of people have gone through, and there is not a higher rate of autism there. Unfortunately, the higher rate of autism does come from advanced paternal age or advanced age of the partner, the male partner. So that is something that increases your risk, but it's not the IVF process alone. And there's lots of studies out there and lots of conflicting information, but that's a myth. And then there should be a myth or a headliner out there that it's easy to get pregnant after 40, even with IVF, which is not the case. If you're using your own eggs, as I said, at 42, the success rate across the nation is about 5 to 10%. It's not very high. And I think that we're under this assumption that, okay, there's all these people in Hollywood that, have children at 50 or 48, and it's not a problem. I'll just wait and I'll just do IVF. But a lot of times, unless you froze your eggs when you were younger, or you decide and elect to use donor eggs, then it isn't as easy to use, get pregnant at 42, 43. So please don't wait thinking that it's going to be fine. You can always just do IVF. That's not the case, unfortunately.
Yeah, that's that, it's sometimes I get so annoyed because you hear so many myths like that, and and it scares people, and a lot of these things aren't true. And so I'm glad you honed into that, especially with the autism, because you hear a lot of myths about autism that aren't necessarily true. Now, one question every patient should ask their doctor or their clinic before starting, what would that be?
I think that you need to ask about success rates, right? And there are different kind of websites that do track clinic success rates. They're called SART or through the CDC, but it can be really confusing to navigate for patients because it's like includes all kinds of patients, whether that be same-sex couples or people using surrogates. So I think the best thing to do is have a direct conversation with your patient. What is my success rate based on my age, my other underlying conditions, and what would you gauge? Because clinic success rates, IVF lab success rates are going to vary, and you won't know until you have that honest conversation with your patient.
And for people who are listening right now, what would be some of the things you really like to emphasize from the conversation we had today that you feel are really important that you would like people to remember from what we discussed today?
Yeah, I really want to hone in on the fact how much age matters. I can't tell you enough how life can get away from you so quickly, and before you know it, you're like, "Hey, I'm just waiting. I'm in my late 30s. I'm in my 40s, and I'll just keep waiting." And then all of a sudden, you come see me at 45, and our options are really, really, really limited. So age is so important. I think being as healthy as you can is not only going to help you with your fertility, but your longevity as a parent too, right? So like every decision we make does matter and impacts our body and our egg quality, our sperm quality. And that's just related to the food we eat, from other kinds of exposures to environmental toxins and pollutants, from drugs, from alcohol, et cetera. So these things matter. They do accumulate in your body and they make an impact. So those are like some critical things. And then the last thing is, please, if you're wondering anything about your body, there is no reason you should hesitate seeking a consultation and talking to someone. You shouldn't feel embarrassed or feel there's this like taboo around it. As I've said before, knowledge is power. So sometimes you're not even planning to do any kind of treatment or IVF. That's fine. You just want the reassurance that there's sperm there, that your tubes are open. You can keep trying. Maybe you work on things more naturally, but please, 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 just if you're wondering about it constantly, it's just best to go get tested and just have that information for yourself.
Oh, I agree. Now, can you tell us about the services that you provide?
Sure, absolutely. So I provide fertility preservation services. That would be if somebody wants to freeze their eggs or embryos, or even is undergoing cancer treatment and has to do chemotherapy and needs to do urgent, egg freezing. We also help couples who are having trouble getting pregnant with infertility. That could be through just helping them with their ovulation and giving pills to help people ovulate, or doing intrauterine insemination or artificial insemination, or IVF, of course, and genetic testing. And then I also help couples with recurrent pregnancy loss. They keep having miscarriages. We delve into figuring out why. I do surgeries on the uterus to correct uterine malformations if they were born with them, or if they have fibroids. So lots of different services, and it just is dependent on what each person needs.
And where can people find you?
Sure. So obviously I'm located in Orange County, California, but you can find me on my website at southcoastfertility.com. I also have my own personal website, which is banakashanimd.com. So you can find me there. I'm also on social media, Dr. Bana Kashani on Instagram, and I would love to have a consultation with you and to see if I can help anyone out there who needs these services.
I love that. And they could probably schedule a Zoom consultation with you also.
Absolutely. Yeah. So we do have virtual consultations available. So we can definitely work around people who don't live in the immediate area as well.
Oh, I love that. Dr. Banna, this has been amazing. I thank you so much. You covered so much valuable information today, and you were very thorough. And I thank you so much for what you're doing. There are so many women and so many men out there that struggle, who want to have children and want to have a family, but there are many different types of things that can, come, that are issues that can, kind of make, something that's so. I guess what I'm trying to say is that, there are so many people out there that want to have a family. They want to have children. They want to give birth. And there's so many reasons why you could have problems during pregnancy, and not be able to conceive. And there's a long list. But people like yourself, who can actually, help them and help them with a sense of compassion, a sense of love, and a sense of, really wanting to help that person, and do it with, not just with your experience, but with your heart. And I think that's so important, because there's a difference between just going to see a doctor and the doctor does their job and leaves the office room, and then you're sitting there and you're all emotional and you just don't know what the next step is. And then there's doctors like yourself who actually come in and you use your knowledge-based information and you use your heart, and you combine those two, and the person leaves with the feeling of hope and the feeling of, this could be a possibility. And that's what I'm trying to basically say, is that I really appreciate that there are doctors like yourself, because there's some sometimes I have to say, from working in the medical field, it's very hard sometimes to find those doctors that have those two components together, and when I come across people like yourself, I really appreciate that, you really care so much about the patient and not just about the buck. So thank you so much for doing what you do, and thank you for everything that you've provided today on our episode to help women and men who are looking to have children and looking to start a family.
Well, thank you so much for all that you do and basically streamlining this process to educate everyone on your platform. You're amazing, and I really enjoyed talking to you, and hope that we can continue our conversation at another time too.
I would love that. And you have a great day. Thank you so much for everything.
You're welcome. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye bye.